So a couple of weeks ago, we had a guest teacher named Aya Santusika, and she talked about happiness. And so that kind of inspired me to talk tonight about happiness and about some practices for cultivating happiness. And of course, that gives me an excuse to talk about the Brahmaviharas and more about that in a few minutes. Now, the thing about happiness is I don't want to be a Pollyanna about it. Happiness can be difficult. There are a lot of neurological limitations on how much happiness we have in our lives. In fact, I have a good friend who is a molecular biologist who says that all of our moods are completely wired in our body chemistry, and there's not a lot we can do about it. And I disagree with that. But there are things that are going on that are neurochemical that we have limited effect on. For instance, I just recently learned about a gene. It's the MTHFR gene, and there are two mutations of this gene that lead to, a number of problems, but the top two are anxiety and depression. So I know some people who have this mutation, and so they have some difficulties, but that doesn't mean that they're immune to happiness and joy. In fact, they experience quite a bit of it. There's a theory about happiness that we all have a set point. That is, there's, you know, if bad things happen, we get unhappy, but we tend to return to the set point. Or we become totally elated over something and we return to that set point. And different people in this theory have different set points. Now, I think that there have been people who have spent some time refuting this theory more recently. And some people still find it at least a useful model. But I believe that we can move that set point, that that set point is not fixed, that we're not born with it. And I'm going to talk more about that later. So I mentioned the Brahmaviharas. I like to talk about happiness because it gives me an excuse to talk about them. The Brahmaviharas are, directly translates. Brahmavihara is a Pali word that translates to abode of the gods or a dwelling place of the divine. And these are said to be sublime or divine states of mind. They're also said to be natural states of the enlightened mind, and they can be cultivated, which leads to sort of a paradox. That is, these states will deepen as your practice deepens, and yet cultivating them deepens your practice. There are four of these Brahmaviharas. They are loving kindness. That's the usual translation. More about that later. And the Pali word is metta. There's compassion or karuna, sympathetic joy or mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. Now, some of tonight's materials are not from the original teachings of the Buddha and come from later sources. In particular, there's a document that's quite important in our lineage, the Theravada lineage, and it's called the Visuddhimagga. And Visuddhimagga means the path of purification. And it's a distillation of all the commentarial material that was available at the time, the 5th century AD in Sri Lanka. It was written by a man named Buddhaghosa. We don't know much about him. He's a highly mythologized figure. But what he did was he took all of this commentarial material. Up to then, there were commentaries on the Buddhist teachings and commentaries on the commentaries and commentaries on the commentaries. And Buddhaghosa took all of this stuff and sort of put it all together into a single work. And it was so good that all of the other scholars of the time, 5th century Sri Lanka, they stopped copying down all the other stuff, most of the other stuff, because this was considered to be so good. So it's not as old as the Buddha's original teachings. It's a whole millennia newer. On the other hand, he was distilling stuff that had been around in practice already for centuries, or he wouldn't have condensed it that way. So it still represents 16 centuries of wisdom, more than 16 centuries. And there's a number of things in it that are quite useful. And it, by and large, follows fairly closely with a few departures from and some additions to the Pali Canon, the oldest of the Buddhist teachings that are available to us today. So let me talk about each one of the Brahmaviharas. And there's a concept in here called near and far enemies, and that is not in the Pali Canon. That's the more recent thing that we get from the Visuddhimagga, but I find it enormously useful because it helps tell us what these states of mind are and what they are not. So the first of the Brahmaviharas is metta, which is usually translated loving kindness, but I know one teacher who likes to use the term radiant friendliness. And I really like that because that's much closer to what it feels like. But loving kindness is sort of the standard. It's been the standard translation for decades now. So the far enemy, sort of the opposite, that's easy. It's anger or ill will. Ill will or anger. So that's straightforward. Now the near enemy. Near enemies are the things that are close to the quality, but are not quite there. They sort of mislead us. So the near enemy of loving kindness is called selfish affection or lust or codependence. There's something selfish about it, self-involved. There's something really generous, naturally generous about real well-wishing, about real radiant friendliness. There's something a little bit selfish about the near enemy. So the second of these states is karuna, or compassion. And the far enemy, of course, is cruelty. Now, the near enemy is really interesting, I think. The near enemy is pity. To me, pity implies aversion, like, oh, I'm glad that's not happening to me. Or condescension. Like, I'm much better off than that. So there's a relief that it's not you. Notice that there's still stuff about me involved in pity. With compassion, there is, as Philip Moffat calls it, just the quiver of the heart, the moving of the heart towards the person who is suffering. The third of these states is mudita, or sympathetic joy. Happiness for others, for the good fortune of others. Now, I have to note here that one teacher has said that mudita really just means plain joy in the Buddha's early teachings. That's the straightforward Pali translation. And really, I did a lot of research on this, and I could not find anything to support that. Certainly by the time of the Visuddhimagga, and I think earlier, mudita, at least in this context, is used to mean sympathetic joy. Now, the usual example that's used to describe sympathetic joy is the joy of a parent watching their child's growth and accomplishments. So the far enemy is resentment or envy. Somebody has good fortune and you're envious of it. You're angry at them. You know, why didn't I get that? Now, the near enemy is sometimes described as frivolous delight or exuberance, which I think are kind of strange translations. To me, it implies kind of vicarious enjoyment, sort of like, oh, wow, I'd feel great if that happened to me. And then the fourth one is, in some ways, the most difficult to understand. It's upekkha, or equanimity. Now, it's not the same as serenity or calm. You can be in the midst of a really chaotic situation and have upekkha. Upekkha means clarity and balance, even when everything is going to hell around you. If you have upekkha, you still have a sense of balance in it. The far enemy interestingly, is craving or clinging. So that's interesting because craving and clinging are really key elements of suffering, of dukkha. So real upekkha, real equanimity, is almost a release from craving and clinging. And the near enemy, and this is important, is indifference or apathy. Equanimity is not about apathy. It's not about not caring. And this is a big deal. In fact, Philip Moffat spent a whole talk on equanimity alone. In fact, several other teachers have as well. It's a huge topic. So it's common across all of the near enemies, I think, is selfing. That is, and I pointed this out, there's this self-involvement, self-engagement. And the near enemy of equanimity is indifference or apathy. You can easily say, oh, I have equanimity about this issue, when what's really there is that you just don't care. So what I see is that all the near enemies have this selfish quality, this self-involvement. And I also believe that unless you are enlightened, your Brahma Viharas are always mixed. The near enemy is always present to some degree, maybe not a lot, but there's always a little bit. There's always an element of self going on. And I think you can learn a lot by observing this. And it's not easy. We don't train ourselves to be mindful of beautiful or exalted states. So we may not notice that there's a little bit of selfishness going on, a little bit of friction that we introduce to each one of these states when they're present in us. But this is a great mindfulness exercise to just try to be aware of that going on. Not to try to get rid of it, because it's not going to go away. Which brings up another point, that when we're aware of pleasant states, and these Brahma Viharas are all pleasant states, they are pleasant in the body. They're felt in the body. They're not just states of mind. They're physical states. They are emotional states. Cultivating mindfulness of pleasant states is an important practice for cultivating happiness. Most of the time, we don't do that. We have a tendency to use mindfulness as a way of fixing bad things, like, oh, I'm in a bad mood. I'll be mindful. I'll look at my bad mood in the body, how it feels. And then we start using mindfulness as if it's some kind of Band-Aid. And that's really unfortunate, because mindfulness of pleasant states is a really great way to develop happiness, just to be aware of them, to know them, and to also be aware that they can be cultivated. I have this example of the self in the state of mudita, of sympathetic joy, empathetic joy. Some years ago, a friend of mine won a Pulitzer Prize for journalist photography. And he deserved it. He took beautiful photographs. He risked his life a number of times to do this work. When I heard the news, my first reaction was, wow, that's great. And then the second reaction was, wow, my friend has won the Pulitzer. I know a guy who won the Pulitzer. It was like a sense of reflected glory. So that second, that rebound effect, that second boomerang thing was a selfish impulse. And it was still, there was a lot of joy, and the joy was primarily on his behalf, but there was still that little selfish bit in there. Now, there's a way we can think about the Brahma Viharas that I think is useful as a sort of a structure around the practices that I'll talk about in a little while. Metta, radiant friendliness, is a fundamental predisposition of mind. It's like a default setting. It's a friendly attitude towards our perception. We talked about radiant friendliness. And when that is strong, or even when it's present weakly, the other Brahma Viharas become much more strongly possible. So metta is a fundamental predisposition of mind, a fundamental attitude. Karuna, compassion, is metta when it encounters someone having a tough time. And mudita, empathetic joy, is metta when it encounters someone having a good time. So when the metta is strong, your compassion will be strong and your empathetic joy will also be strong. If the metta is not there, it's very hard to have metta encounter someone having a tough time. Upekkha, equanimity, is the quality that sustains our balance in all this. We use the words equanimity, equilibrium, equipoise. It's a difficult topic. So again, note the near enemy. It's not indifference. It's not calm. It keeps us from being inundated by other people's suffering, for instance. And this is very important for caregivers. People talk a lot, compassionate people. Caregivers often talk about compassion overload. And this is a real problem with caregivers. Compassion can be really exhausting if it's not balanced with equanimity. So as I said, there are practices for developing all of these. And I'm going to talk first about samatha and vipassana practices. Samatha is usually translated as concentration practice, and it's calming, unifying. And by the way, it also leads to potentially ecstatic states. And I hate the word concentration because that implies squeezing something or boiling it down. It reminds me of orange juice concentrate. It feels like work when I talk about concentration. Really, unification and calming practice is more about relaxation than effort. It's more about letting go than getting something. And the second of these two practices that we talk about, they're really related practices, is vipassana, which is fully receiving the experience of the senses. And this is an important practice. And this is a practice that, concentration practices had been around for a long time before the Buddha. But the vipassana practice, or what we call the mindfulness practice, or the open experience practice, is the Buddha's own introduction to the world of meditation. There is a famous sutta called Advice to Bahia, and I won't go through the whole thing. It's really very entertaining. But Bahia is a guy who just keeps on badgering the Buddha to tell him how to become enlightened, what enlightenment is. And the Buddha finally breaks down and tells him, when in the seen, there is only the seen, when in the heard, there is only the heard, etc. He goes through all of the senses. The idea being that when you can relax all that chatter about what you're seeing and what you're hearing and actually just see and hear, when you can just be with the experience of the senses, you are in a state of enlightenment. I don't know if I agree with that because I think the Buddha says other things in other places, but this is nonetheless very important as a practice. These two approaches to practice are supports for mindfulness. The ability to be in the present moment, for showing up for our lives. That is, concentration practice gives us the strength, the solidity, sort of the platform. And mindfulness practice gives us the discernment. There's a story that Ajahn Buddhadasa, the Thai master, gives as a metaphor to explain this balance. He says, he asks you to imagine that you are standing in front of a big jungle that's between you and a river. It's a hot day. You really want to get to that river and jump in and swim. And the river is sort of the symbol for liberation. But there's a big, dense jungle between you and it. If you had a razor blade, you might be able to cut through one of those bamboo stalks or one of those big old ivy stalks, but it'd take forever to get through. And if you had a baseball bat, it would just bounce off the bamboo. It wouldn't help at all. What you need is one of those Southeast Asian machetes. It has the weight and it has the edge. The weight represents the power of the concentration practice, and the sharp edge represents the discernment of the mindfulness practice. So why do I go through all of this to tell you about these two practices? It's because the Brahmavihara practices help you balance these. It helps you bring these two practices, the concentration and mindfulness practices, into the heart. Why is that important? It's because people often find that meditation practices, both the concentration and the mindfulness, can be very dry. You can easily sit there with mindfulness practice, noticing your arising and passing experience, and start to feel like you're some kind of barcode reader. Concentration practice can just be really boring at times, following the breath. And metta balances that by working to open the heart and give us a friendly attitude towards our experience. And this helps cultivate happiness. Now, there are exercises for cultivating all of these four qualities, but the most common one is for loving kindness, metta, because metta is really the starting point for the other three. And by the way, I know that there's a number of people out there who are teaching compassion practices. And in fact, there's somebody here tonight who has been teaching compassion practice a lot. And I know that the way that she and others teach it, there's a well-established tradition in this by now, is a blending of loving kindness practices and compassion practices put together in a very interesting way. I'm going to focus particularly on loving kindness practice. Loving kindness is actually a concentration practice, which surprised me when I first heard that. It is usually taught as a combination of visualization and chant. And it can lead to jhana. And jhana states are these states that are called deep absorption states. They can be quite ecstatic. They can be difficult to reach. There's a problem. If you want to experience jhana, you probably won't. That's a whole different topic. And I thought that this was quite ridiculous that anybody could reach jhana, a concentration, deep concentration state, using metta practice. Because when I first heard metta practice taught, it sounded way too mental for me. It sounded, and I'll go into this, but it just really got the old thinking mind going. But back to the mindfulness and loving kindness support, balancing each other. I want to read this quote from Gil Fronsdal. The practices of mindfulness and loving kindness support one another. Metta practice complements mindfulness by encouraging an attitude of friendliness toward our experience, regardless of how difficult it might be. Mindfulness complements loving kindness by guarding it from becoming partial or sentimental. Mindfulness can bring freedom. Loving kindness ensures that our path to freedom is not aloof from others. I love that. The practices of mindfulness and loving kindness support one another. Metta practice complements mindfulness by encouraging an attitude of friendliness toward our experience, regardless of how difficult it may be. Mindfulness complements loving kindness by guarding it from becoming partial or sentimental. Mindfulness can bring freedom. Loving kindness ensures that our path to freedom is not aloof from others. So the traditional practice is to direct well-wishing towards someone. And I'm going to go through how it's traditionally taught, although the Buddha did not teach it this way. And I'll come back to this in a little while. First, you spend time calming and settling the mind. Usually metta practice starts with some sitting and following the breath just to settle down. And then you choose a recipient for the metta, a benefactor, for instance, someone for whom you have gratitude. What I like to think of is choose someone who, when you think of this person, you cannot help but smile. Just brings a smile to your face. Visualize that recipient and hold that recipient in your heart. Again, it could be a teacher. It could be a parent. It could be a pet. It could be the Dalai Lama. It could be Nelson Mandela. It doesn't have to be someone that you're close to or that you know personally. And then when you visualize that recipient, you direct well-wishing towards that person. And there's some traditional chants that people use to go along with that. And then there's Phillips chant. And we're gonna end that with that chant tonight, as we usually do. That chant was developed by a group of prisoners at San Quentin. And the usual chants constellate around safe, happy, healthy, and at ease, or in well-being, or knowing freedom. And then you visualize the recipient enjoying these qualities of safety, happiness, good health, and ease. And as the metta deepens, the words may fall away. Then there's what is traditionally taught is then you progress through a traditional order of recipients. And it starts easy, and then it gets harder. Traditionally, we are taught to start with the self, and then we go to benefactor, then loved one, then friend, then neutral person, then a difficult person, and then all beings, sort of radiating to all beings everywhere. Now, traditionally in Asia, you start with the self, and that can be really tough for Westerners. Donald tells the story about how the Dalai Lama, when first teaching in the West, was given a question on paper from one of the people he was meeting that said, "I sometimes don't feel worthy of happiness." And the Buddha, the Dalai Lama was quite baffled by this and really didn't understand it. So I think it's a sort of a cultural issue. And one of the things that the Buddha often said was, no one deserves happiness more than you. Something that can help with this, doing metta for yourself, is to visualize yourself as a child. And for a lot of people, maybe it's just easier to start with the benefactor and go to yourself as second. This progression, by the way, through all these, the order of recipients could take place over one sit or over a long retreat. And it's okay to stay with the easy ones. In fact, when I'm on a metta retreat, I stay with the easy ones. And one teacher says, if your heart is opening, the expansion of recipients is completely natural. By the way, traditionally, and I emphasize this, traditionally you don't do metta for a dead person because it might, quote, interfere with their karma. I don't really know what that means, because my understanding of karma means that you can't interfere with it. You don't own it. So this is kind of a strange belief, and I don't go with it. I often do metta for people who are dead. Now, when you're doing this, it's very easy to get stuck in the story. It's easy to get stuck into home movies. That's something that really got me stuck. And that's why the concentration, starting with the concentration, helps by steadying the mind. It's always okay to go back to the breath. And sometimes when we're doing it, it feels like we're in some kind of schmaltzy Hallmark greeting card. Sometimes it just seems impossible or it just seems downright silly. So here's what I think is really important with metta or loving kindness practice. And that is, you just have to experiment. Everyone is different. And what works for you may not work for me, and vice versa. You do what works. Philip, for instance, really likes the chant that we'll end the evening with. Others find it way too wordy. Some don't chant at all, but do very strong visualization. The Venerable Analia, who is a pretty amazing person to practice with, he sticks to the practice as taught in the Pali Canon itself. He's a guy who won't do things that are in the Visuddhimagga. He's very much a purist, although he makes a point of not putting down people who have other practices. He really emphasizes that. But he sticks with what he sees are the basics. So here's a reading for the Pali Canon about metta practice. And this is repeated in a number of places in the Pali Canon. And this is what the Buddha actually said. This is loving kindness practice as taught by the Buddha. He, the practitioner, he then pervades the first direction with a heart filled with loving kindness. Likewise, the second, likewise, the third, likewise, the fourth. So above, below, and all around. He pervades the entire world everywhere and equally with a heart filled with loving kindness, abundant, expansive, limitless, free from enmity and ill will. Just as a mighty trumpeter makes himself heard without difficulty in all four directions, even so, of all things that have shape or life, there is not one that he passes by or leaves aside, but regards them all with a heart set free through deep felt loving kindness. This particular excerpt is from the Dijin Nikaya, and it's called the Tavijja Sutta. So what he's saying is develop metta in the heart and radiate it in all directions. First one direction, then another, and then all four and above and below. So what some people do in practicing metta, and I find this is a fairly good description of what I do, although there are other things that I throw in. I think it's really helpful to kickstart it with gratitude. Because sometimes metta is just it's hard to cultivate radiant friendliness. But gratitude is something that I can feel fairly easily. I spend a little bit of time just being thankful for being here, thankful for knowing love, for having been loved and for loving, for just being able to breathe, for just as I said during the sit, just for being here. And the next point I want to make is that metta is felt in the body. It's a physical sense of joy in the body. There are two qualities here that the Buddha talks about. The two words are piti and sukha. Piti is usually translated as rapture or joy, and it tends to be sort of energetic, uplifting. It can be almost agitating when it's very strong. Sukha is usually translated as happiness, and it's something much more silky and restful. And you can almost fall asleep, though, which is why you need the piti to help keep the energy going. When piti and sukha are working together in a balance, that and tied to the breath, I find what I do, and other people do too, is think of piti, the energetic quality on the in-breath, and sukha on the out-breath. You can get into a feedback loop, and it starts to self-amplify, and the piti and the sukha grow, and the loving kindness and the radiance and the friendliness also grows. This is a development of a generosity of spirit. And generosity, I think, is closely linked to happiness. As I often say, the happy people that I know are generous, and the generous people that I know are happy. So a good way to experiment, a good way to develop metta, is to go to a metta retreat. For one thing, you're there all day with other people doing meta practice. So you're in a context that's very supportive. And it's a great way to experiment. What works for you? If it's you feeling it in the body as a pleasant sensation, it's starting to work. That's just a really good feedback to keep in mind about metta. Metta is something that's felt in the body, ultimately. So be curious about what can work and what not work. So if you don't feel loving kindness at first, that's okay. If it was easy to experience loving kindness, we wouldn't have to do practices to develop it or cultivate it. What we're doing is cultivating loving kindness because it doesn't come to us naturally or easily. Well, it does come naturally, but sometimes it's just not available to us. So it's really about our intentions. So why is this important? I talked earlier about the happiness set point. We're trying to cultivate loving kindness. This is something I've talked about before, is that they've done brain scans of violinists while they're playing the violin. And they've noticed that the part of the brain that controls the fingers of the left hand are much more strongly developed. They're bigger with more neural connections than in ordinary people. Now, the violinist wasn't born with a big chunk in the brain dedicated to the fingers of the left hand. The violinist developed it through violin practice. This is neuroplasticity. That is, we develop the parts of the brain that we want to. You can learn to play the violin and do that. There are people that I know who have developed anger, and they have anger. They probably have the part of the brain that handles anger much more developed than in most people. That's unfortunate. It's unfortunate in part because, besides not helping with happiness, anger reduces cognition. So developing one's anger makes one stupid. As people in a state of anger, even ordinary people without a strong anger practice, when they're angry, their cognitive faculties are greatly diminished. So neuroplasticity means that we can choose to repattern ourselves positively. When we're cultivating loving kindness, we're actually building up the part of the brain that's good at loving kindness. We can get better at it. We're physically changing our brains while we are reprogramming our minds. And in doing that, we are increasing our capacity for happiness. There are also traditional practices for cultivating karuna, mudita, and upekkha, but the metta is the basis, and it first must be strong, in my opinion. So, to recap, metta practice helps develop happiness in a number of ways. First of all, it encourages you to use gratitude because itself is a powerful practice that supports metta. So when you're doing gratitude, you're also supporting happiness as well as metta. And you're supporting it quite directly. Gratitude is just such a great practice all by itself. Metta cultivates generosity of spirit. And the relationship of generosity and happiness I talked about earlier. Metta is a pleasurable experience, and it's a pleasure that is wholesome. Loving kindness, radiant friendliness is pleasant, and it's a pleasant feeling that is entirely wholesome when it's in its pure state. Of course, we always have that little bit of selfishness as friction in there. And then the other thing is that, and this is sort of a side issue, is if we can cultivate the ability to be mindful of our pleasant states, this is a huge support for happiness. Most of the time, we get so caught up in a pleasant state of mind that we forget to be mindful. We forget to pay attention to what's going on in the body when we're having enjoyment, when we're having happiness. So notice this next time that you're with someone that you love, or when something great happens in your life and something leaps in your body, that joy. Just notice that rather than being glad that this wonderful thing happened, notice what's happening in the body, what the actual physical sensations are. And metta is a fundamental support, as I said earlier, for wisdom and for liberation. Here's a quote that I love from Nisargadatta Maharaj. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. So we have time for questions and maybe answers. Anyone? You can raise your hand. I can see everybody on the same screen. Hey, we might get out of here early. Mary?
I just had a commentary to tell you. It's so, I especially liked your comment about how, you know, no matter what's going on, there's always a little bit of something else going, you know, with it. Like it's almost like the quote about mixed emotions. I just remember going on and it was wonderful. I went on a meta retreat, but the first day or so was like horrible. It was like, oh my God, I was like, why did I do this to myself? I don't want to say this chant anymore. And it was like, ugh. I mean, it was just like, you know, I'd say a chant and then it'd be just like this little voice going on. It was like, ugh. It's like, and it was, but because you're on a retreat, so you can really hear that stuff going on so beautifully. But by the, you know, by the seventh day, I mean, I was like kind of this beautiful, you know, it was like with the radiating friendliness. It was just so, it was really, really, really a lovely, lovely experience. And then, of course, I was doing a back-to-back retreat. So I had to, I was going from the meta retreat to a Vipassana retreat. And I got to watch myself like, I don't want to stop. I don't want to do mindfulness. And it was just so, it's just so funny how, you know, just how you can actually watch these things happen. And luckily, because I had been doing metta, I had enough concentration, I had enough space to actually kind of be amused at this other reaction that was going on at the same time. But I would recommend a metta retreat for anyone. To me, it was one of my better experiences in so many ways. And I really agree that you have to have that metta and the Vipassana. So you've got the wisdom and you've got the loving kindness together, because if you're going to be looking at yourself in any kind of way, you better have some loving kindness and compassion.
Yeah. I would just ask, a sense of humor is also helpful.
Absolutely.
I metta practice is really important to me and very rewarding. And it really didn't open up for me until I went on a retreat and experimented, until I found something that really worked for me. And I can sit down now and do a metta sit, but it really wasn't available to me, because that gave me the opportunity to find out what worked for me. But something else that I forgot to bring up, I'm glad you pointed this out, because other people will probably bring this up too, is a lot of people will go on a meta retreat and then spend days dealing with anger and violent, violent fantasies and things like that. The thing about metta is, when you start to try to cultivate metta, you're going to run into the things that obstruct metta, the things that are in the way. So all that stuff that's in your heart may come up for you in a way that usually stays suppressed. But you go on a metta retreat or even sit down and do a metta sit, and it may come up for you in a way that you've got to work through it until you get to the experience of metta. And it doesn't mean to ignore it. You have to work with it, and that's a whole nother topic, of course. Somebody else. Barbara.
Now I'm, yeah, I really like your stuff about gratitude. And we've talked about it a lot between us too. One of the ways I use gratitude with metta is feeling gratitude for the people I'm doing metta for. And even like the people that are the difficult people, you can feel grateful because it's interesting. They've offered you this challenge, you know, and it actually, you can have that texture just in general. I find that helpful.
That's helpful. By the way, Barbara has a very strong metta practice. She says metta for more than 100 people every night before going to bed. Someone else. Liz.
Yes, you know, I'm in this training, mindfulness training program through Sounds True. 2,500 people and all over the world. And my experience is, everyone I've talked to, many, many people, a couple of hundred, metta is the most important practice for all these people, the practice they love most, the practice they do most. And it was very interesting to see that, how worldwide this practice has been accepted and loved. And it was very interesting to see that. And they don't find it hard, I don't think. Maybe they're experienced, but they're doing it and loving it. I'm very interested in equanimity, by the way. I'm glad you talked about equanimity. I have a terrible time with equanimity. I don't get it. I'm so glad that you mentioned that it's maybe tough to be with. I remember telling Sally once, I don't believe in equanimity. and I've said that several times because I haven't. It always seemed like spiritual bypass to me. I'm still working on it, but I'm grateful to you because you said you gave a definition of equanimity the first time in 25 years that I've heard something that helped me understand it, which is release from craving and clinging in the moment. You didn't say in the moment, I've added that. But right. Thank you so much. That is a wonderful definition that I can be with and have equanimity with.
Well, you know, I've told this story before. I was once driving in the Sierras in a very old VW bug, and the brakes gave out. And so I was clearly not calm. I was not serene. I was not apathetic either. And I realized years later, looking back on it, that I did have equanimity. I did the right thing. I hit the emergency brake. I steered my way to the shoulder. Fortunately, I wasn't near a cliff. And, you know, there was a lot of skidding and, you know, skidding around and gravel being thrown up. You know, and was, you know, people ran over to ask if we were okay afterwards. But I realized that I had equanimity, but calm was not there. Serenity was not there. So a sense of balance, the ability to do the right thing, that is, you know, that the mind was still there. I still had a certain kind of attention and intention. So I think of that as being, I had equanimity. It's a good thing I did because I wouldn't be here otherwise.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the release from craving and clinging, which for me is very powerful.
And I don't think it completely releases craving and clinging, but it's in opposition to it. If you have equanimity, the craving and clinging are much reduced, much lowered. So, and of course, when there's craving and clinging, there's no equanimity. You can think of it that way too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Karina.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this talk. As you know, I'm new to a lot of these concepts, but I'm not really new. When you talk about it, I get it because I've been living this. You know, it's like when you're when you're talking to someone and you feel like they're listening, but they're immediately interjecting themselves into the listening process and you just feel not heard. I just feel like I bounce around these things. I never knew the words for a lot of it, but I feel like I've bounced around. So it's just a great, I love this whole idea of the near and far enemies. It's just amazing. I'd like to dig deeper into this.
And, it's very useful.
Yeah. So I feel like a lot of it is up for me right now and just really starting to see. You know, I'm in a 12-step program and we write an inventory. It's one of the big parts of it is you write your, you know, your life story. And I was listening to Gil the other morning and he so clearly explained it. And so there's such an, you know, overlap of 12-step and Buddhism that I always heard was there, but I never actually got to see it. And this just, you know, it's all that, the idea, it's different words instead of, you know, defects of character, you use wholesome and unwholesome and skillful and unskillful. But all of these concepts just keep coming up for me and having a new way to look at it helps me to work through it in a different way. So I really appreciated this. Thank you.
Thank you. By the way, there is a cheat sheet that lists the near and far enemies on the Marin Sangha website under the resources page. So it's one page long. So if you forget, if you want to be reminded what the near and far enemies are, well, that's a great place to go. It's just a one page PDF.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So I think it's time for us. Linda, this will be the last one.
Just wanted to comment. I loved your what you said about our path is not aloof from others.
No, that's
we
Gil.
Sometimes so get caught up in, you know, my sitting, my concentration, my progress that we're not existing in a vacuum, and that without others we really have no practice. Certainly the Brahmaviharas are all about others.
Yes. That's a wonderful quote. I can't take credit for it. It's Gil. And I just love that quote and read it every chance I get.
Thank you.
Thank you.